Wealth can be measured in many ways. As it grows, life can quickly become complex, creating the need for more focused planning. Welcome to We're Talking Money with OmniStar Financial Group. OmniStar has been helping clients achieve financial success for more than 20 years in a client-centric and stress-free environment. With a reputation built on a long track record of working with people who want to grow and protect their assets, OmniStar illuminates the blind spots and provides actionable strategies to help you achieve what's most important. This is where you can count on straightforward and unbiased advice from a team of professionals that are passionate about your success.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today on our first episode of OmniStar's We're Talking Money, the Expert Series, where we talk and interview experts to get no-nonsense information on parts of our 10 elements of financial planning. These parts are risk management, investments, tax planning, estate planning, family planning, cash flow management, lifestyle, business, philanthropy, and inheritance. Hi, my name is Alex Nolan, and I'll be your host today as we sit down to interview Phil Clark on the topic of life insurance. Phil, why don't you give us a little bit of your background and why you're an expert on life insurance before we dive in?
Hey, Alex, thanks for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to talking with you and sharing thoughts around this very old subject of life insurance. Alex, I started in this industry a long time ago, around 1991. A big part of my career, at least the first 10 years or so, I spent a lot of my career on the sale of life insurance, using it in a number of forms, and learned a lot about life insurance before moving into a fee-based advisory role. And my belief is that my experience has given me a knowledge of life insurance that allows me to provide clients with an understanding of how it works, when to use it, how it's best used, and the types that they should consider. Still a lot of fun for me to talk about life insurance, though we use it in a much different way today than we did way back then. My knowledge hopefully will give your listeners a little something today that will help them learn and be better educated.
That sounds great, Phil. As we start on the topic of life insurance, we're here to set the record straight with some no-nonsense information and hopefully illuminate some blind spots that come with a sometimes simple but also fairly complex topic, depending on which type you're talking about and who you're talking to. To get started, let's start with the basics, and that really is, how do we come up with how much insurance we really need? There's three ways to do this, and the first way is through what is called the human life value. Put simply, the human life value is how much insurance you need, basically just to replace your income. The purpose of that is just so that your family or those who depend on you will have your income stream provided to them in a lump sum payment that they could continue to live off of as if you were still working. One concern with this method and something our listeners should be aware of is that usually, you're not going to be factoring in things and larger expenses like college, weddings, vacation home, anything that may come into play. And often, people don't factor in raises that they may be receiving from employment. So there could be a couple blind spots when you use that method to calculate the value of your insurance, but at least it's a way to come up with a number instead of just saying, I'm going to buy a couple million and we'll see how that goes. The other way to do it is through financial needs analysis, and this is a little bit more complex. We're really going to dive in, take a look at all of the different expenses that you may have over your lifetime. And so weddings, the home purchases, maybe funding your children's college, and even potentially considering things like, charitable donations you may want to make along the way. Last way to really do it is through comprehensive planning. And this is what we try to focus on with our clients. And the reason why we use comprehensive planning is that we don't want to be overpaying for insurance or purchase the wrong type of insurance or, worst of all, not have enough insurance. And so we sit down with a client, we want to talk through their scenario, and then we're going to model it so that if the worst does happen, their future does not change. And so, the goal here is really just have enough insurance in place that the plan that you are currently on is not derailed in any way should the worst happen. And it's truly the way you should be planning with insurance is to make sure that it covers the need that you have and not doing anything besides what you need. Transitioning to the different types of insurance. First off, we have term insurance. This is probably the most common type of insurance you've heard about. And It's not one size fits all, like many would have you believe if you listen to radio shows or TV shows. It's definitely the most talked about type of insurance, but it makes up less than a quarter of actually the insurance market share. So when you think about term, it's going to be your pure life insurance. It's usually for a period of years, and you're locking in coverage for usually 10, 20, or 30 years. There are some annually renewing contracts, but those are usually less likely to be used unless for a specific cause that might only be a few years long. This type of coverage is going to be best used if you have a high income potential or a high need for insurance, but right now you might not be making a whole lot. And here at OmniStar, we work with a lot of dental clients and medical clients. A lot of these practitioners get out of school with us. So they have a very high potential for income and their life value is very high, but out the gate, they can't afford more expensive types of insurance, especially when they may need $4, 5, 6 million of insurance. So term is a great fit for somebody in that bucket who might need to cover the needs of their family, and they have a large need but a low appetite to pay a very high premium. The next type of insurance is going to be whole life insurance. And so whole life is your traditional permanent insurance. So if you call term the traditional short-term option, whole life's your traditional permanent option. Whole life offers insurance for your whole life, as there's a reason why it's in the name. Whole life insurance is typically best if you have a permanent need for insurance, if you have estate planning needs, or you need some insurance that's going to go well beyond your working years, and if you need to be able to predict that a little bit in advance, if you can tell that, you know, there might be concerns with your family, you may have a spouse that may have a condition well into retirement, you might insure yourself to be able to provide a benefit for them. What's different between whole life and term is it has a cash value component. What is important about it is that that cash value component and the insurance component are combined. As Phil talks about universal life in a minute, you'll see that the cash value and the insurance component are not always combined, and this can cause some concerns down the road. Because the cash value and the insurance component are combined, the premiums are typically level, so you have a very predictable cost annually as you continue to pay the policy. These cash values and death benefits on whole life contracts go up every year through dividends that are paid by mutual companies. Some non-mutual companies do offer whole life, and their conditions are usually a little bit different, but the vast majority of whole life policies are sold by mutual companies. And when you are a policy owner, similar to a stockholder in a company, you have the right to the dividend. And so this dividend will credit toward your cash value, increasing the cash value and increasing the death benefit on the contract. This cash value can be taken tax-free for loans. It can also be used to cover costs. It can be fully surrendered at a later date. But the cash value in a whole life contract is the best way to think about it is it's very predictable. There's not going to be a crazy fluctuation from one year to the next. And if the worst happens, you do have cash available to use for your benefit. Phil, if you don't mind, take us away on universal, and this is definitely the more complex policy.
Yeah, so great job on describing term and then whole life. What it is in the name, I've been in this business for 30 years. I've never really thought of it like that, but I like the way you refer to it. So whole life, as Alex said, still the go-to for what everyone refers to as the Cadillac in insurance. Here's what is confusing in the insurance world. When you take term insurance and try to marry it to whole life, you get this thing called universal life. And so you have this hybrid. And it can be pretty darn confusing because, like term, it is priced much lower. Like whole life, it has some elements of permanency. This kind of policy can stay with you for the rest of your life, but there's caveats. And so the universal life being a little more complicated probably deserves some and maybe some education. So let me see if I can get this thing to a point that's understandable. And I'm going to talk about three types, Alex. There's indexed universal life, which a lot of agents are out there selling this kind of product today that bets on a index or a stock market index. They bet on that as a way to help grow the cash value versus the guaranteed version or what we'll call a fixed universal life, which has a stated interest rate set by the issuing insurance company. And it can go up or down. Usually it'll have a floor, but it can go up or down. So the index, on the other hand, if the market is going up, you're going to participate in that market rally or rise. And if the market goes down, your cash value is protected. It does not go down with the market. In a lot of ways, it sounds like the perfect contract. The problem comes into play when you start to unwind or unwrap the contract and look at how it's built. So you have cost of insurance, you have mortality and expense charges, as they call them. You have taxes on this policy, you have fees and expenses that are applied. And so it's not the most expensive contract in the UL world, but it can be expensive. And then that contract goes into one that's a little more complicated, and it is an investment-related contract, and that's the variable UL. And so in that contract, you have these cash values, just like you do in a traditional universal life contract. But now you have the addition of mutual funds, or sub-accounts, as they call them. And so these sub-accounts add yet another layer of cost or fees. So just like in a mutual fund, you have an expense ratio, you have that same thing in your universal life contract now. So you have mortality and expense charges, you have expense ratios of the funds, the administrative cost, the taxes. That policy can cost you 3, 4, and sometimes more percent per year, which means for that cash value to grow, which is partly why you want one of these contracts. If you have cash value in a contract, you really want it to go up, because at some point it's either going to be given back to you for spending money, or it's going to be used to offset premium. And so if that cash value is not growing, then you probably have a concern. And here's why it might not grow. Performance of the market, or performance of the indexes, or maybe the interest rate set by the insurance company. Any of those things could give you poor performance. But even if it performs, the cost of insurance is offsetting some of that performance every year, because every year that you reach another birthday, you also get an increase in your premium cost or in your cost of insurance. What's interesting about the universal life is the insurance company may not send you a bill to say, hey, your cost of insurance went up, pay us a little more. You'll keep a level premium, and it'll feel a lot like whole life. You can pay more, you can add more to the contract, and in some cases you can pay less. But they won't necessarily send you something until the contract is in danger of lapse, at which point you're going to be faced with, in some cases, some pretty large premium contributions to get that policy back in a place of sustainability. Otherwise, you run the risk of lapse. So these policies can be a great tool. They can also be very dangerous because of these moving parts. You know, Alex, one of the things that I ran into a lot early in my career was so many of the agents selling these contracts didn't really understand the nuances, and they would sell a contract and sell it as though it was whole life with all kinds of guarantees, yet they would let the client stay under this perception that, wow, this thing is so cheap and it's guaranteed, why wouldn't I do it? I think a lot of insurance got sold that way, and today, 15, 20 years later, some of those same people, some of those policyholders, I can imagine they're struggling trying to figure out what to do with those policies, because today, unless they funded them with a lot of excess premium, those policies are probably in danger of lapse today and are going to cost them a lot more money. So it can definitely change over time. I'd say that the policy you have to be most careful with is universal life. To your point, term, easy. It's predictable, certain term. Whole life, predictable, cost a little more. Universal life, man, there's a lot of unpredictability there.
That's great, Phil. And I know there's one other type called the GUL, but before we go into that, you kept mentioning something. You can pay more. When we talk about whole life and we talk about term, you know, we don't really mention this idea of paying more. You know, then there's this there's a concept called a MEC limit, where you can only put so much cash into a policy. And, you know, I think that's a topic for another time, but paying more concept is very, very popular in the IUL community and people that sell IULs. Do you want to go into that a little bit? I mean, if it was me and I didn't know, you know, I didn't work in the industry, I probably wouldn't want to pay more for my life insurance. And one other thing, when we go into that, maybe you can explain the difference between what you're investing in those index products versus the stock you're investing in a variable contract. Because if you're not actually investing in the stock, what are you investing in?
That's a great question, Alex. I'm glad you brought that up. So first, the concept of overfunding a policy has been around a long time. It's not new. And the idea, the concept is there's a certain amount of money that must go in that contract to cover cost of insurance and the underlying fees. And anything above that amount is moved directly into the cash value account that can accumulate in a tax-preferred way. And so what I mean by that is no tax on the growth, and potentially you can distribute a lot of that money with no tax. It's a type of loan. You can take as much as you've paid into the contract, so you can take your principal, if you will, or premiums paid, and then switch to loans. And you literally could take that money out tax-free. Overfunding becomes a very useful way to do it because you're not paying more for the insurance. You're simply trying to grow that cash value, that pot of money that you might be planning to spend at some point during retirement, or maybe you've got a certain expense that is earmarked to be covered with that pot of money. The problem with overfunding is there's two things. One, you've already mentioned, that's the MEC, or the Modified Endowment Contract. That's a set of rules that basically says you have to pass a test. The insurance company will run this test for you. And basically, you cannot put more in that policy than that MEC limit will allow. And if you do, that policy becomes taxable. And I don't mean just the cash value, but you could create a taxable death benefit. So now all of a sudden, what was an efficient way for you to save money and create wealth just became a very expensive way to create wealth or to access cash. So that is problem one. There is another problem potentially with the overfunding. If you start funding more and more money into that contract and performance is not so good and cost of insurance is going up, what looks in the early years like you're really accomplishing something, you can find that a lot of that excess cash gets eroded due to cost of insurance rising and poor performance. The other piece that you ask about was better explain the difference in variable and index universal life. Simple. Everybody knows that we've got something called an S&P 500 index. Well, that's a real investment. You can put money in that, buy it just like a stock, and it performs or it doesn't perform. And if it goes up, you make money. If it goes down, you lose money. Think of that for the variable universal life. You are literally investing in real mutual fund type investments. Index UL, on the other hand, allows you to, you're actually allocating your cash value to a index like the S&P 500, but the money doesn't go in that index. The money is with the insurance company. And so that insurance company is going to promise you a return based on the performance of the underlying index. But your money's never in that index, so it's not an investment product, though it sounds like one. So you're investing with the insurance company takes your premium, and they use that premium to buy option contracts on those indexes. And if the index performs, they are able to pay you the promised amount of return to a limit. They have a cap on these things generally. And the difference, what we call the spread, is how they make profit. So if the index performed at 12% and they said you get 80% of that performance with maybe a 10% cap, then in that case, you'd get, say, 9.6%. A pretty good day's work, not bad. On the other hand, if that index performed at 25% like it did in 2018, I guess it was, or 2019 when the markets performed so well, you'd still be limited to 10%. Still a good return, though. If the market is down or negative, this is where the index performance begins to seem a little more attractive. That simply means that if it goes down or negative, meaning the index, you don't participate in that. The insurance company guarantees that you can never earn less than 0%. So interesting tools there. They look and sound similar, in some ways identical, but they are quite different.
The last type of UL, just to round out that topic, is what's called a guaranteed UL. and this is probably the truest combination of term and whole life. The reason why that is you're basically buying a universal contract that'll be guaranteed to age 100, 110, 121, but it's buying permanent term insurance. There will be a cash value in it usually near the start, but cash value usually dwindles out of the account pretty quickly. And they're set up basically to provide a guaranteed death benefit.
Yeah, that's a good point, Alex. The guaranteed universal life, I think it's best used for permanent situations where cash value is not an important thing. It's not something that's going to be needed. So think about a trust for an estate, some place that the money, or rather the policy, is in an irrevocable chassis. So you couldn't access the cash anyway. In that case, cash value is not important. You just want a guaranteed benefit and you want to know what the premiums are going to cost. And so to your point, there's a little cash value on the front end, but basically that insurance company's priced that contract based on no cash value ever accumulating. And so it is more like term, but you have the effect of whole life because you can solve, or your agent could solve, for age 100 or 110. Like you said, I've seen them go as far as 130 now. So you can solve for anything you want. And now you've got the best of both worlds in most ways. But a good contract, if you've got a permanent need, but premium amount is a concern, as long as you have those things as part of what you're trying to accomplish, meaning you need a lot of death benefit, lowest amount of premium, and you have no need for cash value, I think it's a really good, really good product.
That's great to hear. As we start to wrap up today, we're going to go through company paid versus personal insurance. This is an important topic because a lot of people will say, hey, I already have insurance through my employer. Why do I need any more for myself? And just to kick us off, some common numbers is that you will typically have between 1 and 5 times your salary. Usually it's 1 or 2 times salary provided by the employer. In rare cases, it's more than that. And if you think about the cost to live, it's typically quite a bit more than 1 or 2 times your salary. If you pass away and your family has to replicate your income until they can get back on their feet, you may need 10, 20, 30 times that amount. Phil, do you want to go into that a little bit and talk about the, you know, some of the concerns, and then I can wrap us up with why it might be prudent to, you know, get your personal contract?
Yeah, that's a great point. So you just hit on something that is overlooked when it comes to comprehensive planning or to general planning. A lot of advisors out there, they forget this part. Clients all the time have forgotten this part. And so I think it's important that your listeners understand that corporate life insurance or company paid life insurance generally is going to be limited, exactly as you said, 2, maybe 3 times. But if you think about withdrawal rates from a portfolio, so all of a sudden there's a premature death, the breadwinner is gone, and now the family is going to depend on that death benefit. If you think about the recommended withdrawal rate by nearly any expert out there, including our firm, you know, around 4 to 5% is what you would think to take and what we would recommend. And you really wouldn't want to go beyond that because you run the risk of spending down that portfolio. If you did that simple math, Alex, you're right. It could be 20 times someone's salary to give that family what they were used to living on prior to the breadwinner's death. Certainly 10 times is not unusual. So some of the weaknesses of company-paid life insurance is, 1, not having enough. 2 is portability. Maybe you can't take it with you. And if you can, what does that look like? Is the premium going to be affordable? And then the other thing is, likely it is a type of term insurance. It's probably not permanent. What your life insurance is to be used for, when you're going to need it, or how long it needs to be in place, those things have to be considered before you decide that employer-paid insurance is enough. So I think there's a lot of mistakes that get made in that arena, and I would encourage anyone looking to plan better as it relates to their life insurance needs, know what those life insurance amounts are through your employer, share that with your advisor, they need to know that, and then be open to the idea that it probably is not going to be enough, and you're going to need something to supplement that if you truly want to take care of your family. If that's important to you, chances are you're going to need to do something different than rely solely on employer-paid coverage.
There's some great points, Phil. One important fact is that insurance is cheaper the younger you are. Many of our listeners will probably know that. A lot of people can guess that. You get older, you get less healthy, costs go up. So one concern with the employer-paid coverage is that as you reach 55, 60, 65, if you're laid off, you decide to move and change your job, or you, for whatever reason, you may have a separation from your employer. And let's assume that the coverage is portable. Well, it might be annually renewable term, or it may have to be converted into permanent coverage. Either option is going to drastically increase your premium. On the other side, it may not be portable or convertible, in which case you lose your coverage. If you're like a lot of Americans right now, plenty of people in their 50s and even early 60s still have a need for life insurance. The reason why I mention this is that it can be a lot cheaper to simply purchase coverage in your 30s, 40s, or even early 50s that are individual contracts. And then at that point, you would not have to worry about what your employer provided you. You could simply rely on your personal coverage. And if you don't need it anymore, cancel the contract and stop paying the premiums. So what now? To really get started, you need to identify your need for life insurance. And to do that, you need to speak with a professional who is well-versed in financial planning and does not have an agenda behind their recommendations. We typically recommend starting with a fee-based advisory firm like our own. If you reach out to someone who is a captive agent, you're likely going to only have one or two solutions presented to you from their company. It's always wise to research what you're purchasing before you dive in. And if at all possible, do comprehensive planning before deciding to make a purchase. Thank you for joining us today on the expert series of We're Talking Money. We look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thanks for joining us on We're Talking Money. Be sure to visit our website, www.omnistarfinancial.com, where you can learn more about how we provide value to our clients. Subscribe to the show and our newsletters, and drop us a line with suggestions for upcoming shows. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. This podcast is a publication of OmniStar Financial Group. Any information provided has been prepared from sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy is not guaranteed, does not represent all available data necessary for making business or investment decisions, is for informational purposes only, and does not represent or constitute any recommendations. All expressions of opinion reflect that of the authors and are subject to change. If this podcast contains any projections, forecasts, guarantees, and/or predictions of any kind, you're required to ignore the same. OmniStar is not engaged in the practice of law or accounting, and any information in this podcast should not be construed legal or tax advice. Any distributions, use, or copying of this podcast, other than the intended recipients, is unauthorized.